Hi, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Dr. Sonia Sonalesis joins me to talk about her vision for the Baltimore City Public Schools. Every day, 80,000 students are given the chance for a future with the kind of opportunity that only a solid education can provide. But how good a chance are we giving them? Nearly a quarter of students live in poverty, and many live in neighborhoods plagued by violence and despair. Dr. Sonalesis says we need to care for the whole child. A federal grant announced last week, for example, is intended to promote student resilience. What does that mean, and what's reasonable to ask of teachers and principals when it comes to addressing issues of systemic inequality in our city? A conversation about reading, writing, arithmetic, and restoring faith in public education. Midday gets underway right after these headlines. Good afternoon, everybody. Glad you're with us. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. My guest this afternoon is the new CEO of Baltimore City Public Schools, Dr. Sonia Sonalesis. Dr. Sonalesis is no stranger to the city school system. She was chief academic officer for the system from 2010 to 2013. For 3 years after that, she served as vice president for K-12 policy and practice at the Education Trust, a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit focused on closing the achievement gap experienced disproportionately by African-American, Latino, and Native students, as well as students from low-income families. Earlier in her career, she was an assistant superintendent in the Boston Public Schools, not far from West Peabody, Massachusetts, the city where she grew up. Before joining the Boston Public Schools, Dr. Sonalesis lectured on urban education at Harvard University. She spent 6 years as a senior associate with a company called Focus on Results, where she worked with five major urban districts, coaching superintendents and training school leaders. Before that, Dr. Sonalesis served as executive director of the New York City Algebra Project. She is a Phi Beta Kappa graduate of Brown University. She holds a master's degree in education administration from Columbia and a doctor of education from Harvard University. She has lived in Baltimore with her husband and their three daughters since 2010. It's great to see you. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
So during the mayoral campaign, I interviewed everybody and their mother who were running for mayor. There were a lot of them. And almost all of them contended that the school system doesn't have basic information about its budget or about even the enrollment. For example, they were contending that we don't really know how many students are in the system. This seems to be a number that's a moving target. Now, I know you don't actually come up with a solid number until the end of this month.
That's right.
But are you confident that we'll know how many students we're educating, and what's your guess as to the number at this juncture? Because it seems to be a guess on everybody else's part.
No, well, it is, and as you noted, that, you know, there's a reason why the end of this month is our target for knowing that question. I am confident that we will be able to get that number. And, you know, the other reality in large school districts is the variety of factors, right, that impact how young people get counted. So there's a certain number of days that young people need to be in attendance that for a certain amount of time that indicates whether we can count them, whether they've been immunized by the particular time. So that's one of the things that contributes. And then there's just the transience and the movement of our families. And so, you know, there are young people who move in the middle of the year, some who move in at the end. We have schools that for our older students where young people come in after that September 30 count date. But if an administrator or a teacher or a member of a student support team is successful in re-engaging a youth that has previously disengaged, they're not officially part of the count, but we count them because they're still young people in our schools.
Are you under the impression that the number of students is steadily trending down, that we really do have fewer now than we did 3 years ago, 5 years ago? Do you expect that trend to continue? What do you see coming up in the next 2 or 3 years?
So in terms of just my cursory view coming in, I do think, excuse me, that in the last couple of years, we have seen some trending down. And part of our work in helping to move that up is continuing to make city schools a viable option for all families within the city. There's still a great deal of work we can do in keeping all of our young people throughout their K-12 continuum, and we know that. We know that there are places that we really need to make sure that families know their options and that we have high-quality options for them. And then in other parts of the city, our schools are subject to the same demographic patterns and shifts as they are in other urban areas. And in that way, you know, cities are in connected ecosystems. They're not kind of individual parts, right? Schools are impacted by things like jobs and industry and housing. And we see some of that trending. But our focus, particularly within city schools, is to continue to maintain high quality options for a variety of our young people, of all of our families. And if we can do that, then I'm confident that we can see an upward trend.
Absenteeism is a challenge that you all face. I mean, every school district in the country faces it. That also seems to be trending upwards. 2013, the estimate was like 23.3%. Last year, 2015, it's almost 25% of kids who are chronically absent, just not coming to school very often. And obviously, that leads to some pretty rotten results, ultimately. What can you do to turn that number around?
Well, and it's great that you're asking this question now, because we just had our first cross-functional meeting centrally on absenteeism. And one of the things that we need to do, which is what you just referenced, albeit indirectly, is to make sure that we are looking at different populations of students in terms of absenteeism, right? All absences are not created equal. So we know, for example, there are different reasons why young people in pre-K and K, some of the grades where we actually see heightened absentee rates, the drivers for that absenteeism look different than absences from young people in middle school or in high school. The other piece that we know, and that there's been a great deal of national attention and research around, is that chronic absenteeism is not easily addressed through incentive award programs, right? Of which, you know, we have a number of them, and they're useful in helping to boost absenteeism. But when we're talking about young people facing chronic absences, we need a more holistic approach. We know that there are deep connections to poverty. There are deep connections to isolation and other factors, right? There are reasons why we have principals who make their outreach to young people actually outreach to young people and their families, because chronic absenteeism is different. So one of the things that we talked about in that meeting just last week is, as a system, we need to have strategic responses as well as strategic actions that don't treat all absenteeism the same. And where we really need to shore up, at least within recent years, is going back to some of the robust work that the district was doing when I was CAO around chronic absenteeism.
Yeah, you were really chief academic officer.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it is a multidimensional, very complex, very nuanced problem. You talk a lot about educating the whole child. What does that mean to you?
So educating the whole child to me means that we have we recognize that young people's academic success is also linked to their physical well-being, their emotional well-being, being part of a vibrant and healthy social network. And that ultimately, you know, I will always hold, and it's the academician in me, right, that schools are really the only institution singularly responsible for making sure everybody reads, everybody can do math proficiently. And so we will never abandon that. However, you cannot be in a city, in a community like Baltimore, and ignore the other elements that contribute to young people's readiness. And frankly, for all of our children, wherever they live, our kids are whole beings. Like, they want to be artists and musicians, and they want to run and jump too. And, you know, they have different personalities and want to be engaged in that. So educating the whole child means recognizing that if we want to yield academic success, we really have to know our kids as full human beings and full people.
And that's asking so much of the principals and teachers, isn't it?
I mean,
the police talk about this a lot, too. Yeah. So, you know, yeah. we're not just here to police. Now we've got to be running these, mm-hmm. you know, recreational mm-hmm. leagues, and we've got to be, you know, having movie nights, and we've got to be communicating and helping kids when we find them, you know, heading down a path that they shouldn't be heading down. Teachers, you know, it's hard enough to teach them reading and math, and it's, you know, to put this burden. You guys just got a big grant from the federal mm-hmm. government mm-hmm. for student resilience. It's a mental health program.
That's right.
They're trained as educators. They're not shrinks.
Well,
right?
It's true, but I think one of the things that I've been very clear about saying is we are not expecting teachers to now become licensed clinicians. That's not what this is about. As a matter of fact, it is a lot of frontline educators, teachers, principals who are asking for training that helps them recognize, right, some of the outward manifestations of certain experiences with trauma that kids have. And so our approach, what I'm describing, really requires networking beyond just school walls, because you are absolutely right. It is hard enough to make sure a child is grade level in their knowledge of science as a seventh grader. I'm not now asking that seventh grade science teacher to become a licensed clinician or to, you know, be able to do eye screenings. I'm not asking them to do that. But what we do know is our frontline folks are asking for more assistance, both in their own knowledge. How do I recognize? How do I even know when to refer a young person? They're asking for more assistance in how do we prevent, meaning how do we create in our classroom environment those situations that are conducive, right, for young people to be able to engage academically. And there are things that as educators we can do. And then third, let me know who I can partner with, right? Let me know who I can partner with if a family, you know, needs help getting transportation from one place to the other to get a particular service. Or better yet, in some of our schools, we have the services located within the schools. So by that, believe me, I know how hard teaching is. And we're not asking teachers or principals to do all of that. But what we are saying is we need to have those resources more readily available in schools and to families.
Dr. Sonia Sontelisis is the new CEO of the City Schools here in Baltimore. She began this very complicated gig on the 1st of July. You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Schools have become, in some neighborhoods, real central locations mm-hmm. for a variety of services, not just for the children, but for their parents.
That's right.
You know, there's high school equivalency courses that are being given. There are eye clinics and audiology clinics. Something along the lines of 85% of the students that you're working with qualify for free or reduced meals. Mm-hmm. So you're dealing with a population that, you know, has a lot of complicated needs. What do you think about this trend, these so-called community schools, where the school is the real sort of fulcrum of the neighborhood? Mm-hmm. It's the fundament that helps everybody in all generations get through what they got to get through.
Yeah, well, and it's funny that you mentioned that, because we have had a real effort that began even before I came on board, and we've just accelerated it with the Baltimore Board of Commissioners. And the school board has been very supportive and, frankly, active in promoting this idea of community schools. I think where we are now is we need to be clear on our terms. A lot of people use community schools to mean very different things. At the heart of community schools is really a sense, I think, that schools belong to the community, that they are not some foreign, withdrawn entity that kind of comes in and becomes a receptacle for
right.
all of the kids in the community, but that actually is a place that the community has input in, right? And it's a place where families can gather, as you noted, for other purposes. And that's not something that is so foreign to many communities. I mean, there are many suburban communities you go to, and there's all kinds of activities going on. And parents very much feel as if they have the right and the access to know and shape what's going on. What we're saying is that here in the city, in all sections of the city, schools need to be seen as an extension of the community. And that's what community schools are for me.
But it's got to be done in a way that doesn't place, again, this burden on teachers and principals. I mean, you're talking about just the logistics of it, the hours that the building is open.
Yeah, sure.
You know, the school isn't just from 8 to 2:30 anymore.
Well, and it's really interesting because some of the biggest supporters of community schools have been school leaders who have said that it is absolutely vital and essential to how they're moving their school community. So Principal Guzman, who's we were at Matthew Henson, where we had the pleasure of receiving the grant that will help, you know, that you referenced earlier. And one of the things that Principal Guzman said was, I can't imagine, right, leading this school and not having it be connected to the community. And we have numerous other principals who have said this actually makes their work easier when they have those connections. So instead of seeing it as a layering on, we need to equip school leaders and teachers on how this actually helps them move their own work.
Dr. Sonia Santelices, she's the CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll take your questions and your comments and ideas for Dr. Santelices. You can give us a call, 410-662-8780, 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wipr.org, or you could send us a tweet at our new Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall, @MiddayTomHall. So your thoughts on the Baltimore City Schools coming up, your questions and comments for Dr. Sonia Santelices. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Back in a minute. Welcome back. It's Midday on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. We're taking a look at some of what we have coming up for you this week on the broadcast. Tomorrow, a conversation about what makes a great city great. The urban planning legend Jane Jacobs is the subject of a new biography by Robert Cannigal. He'll be joining me along with Ed Guntz, an architecture critic and writer for the Baltimore Brew. And Wednesday, Mike Rowe, the star of Dirty Jobs and Somebody's Got to Do It, visits to talk about his work helping to minimize the skills gap in today's labor force. That's coming up later this week on Midday. If you're just joining us today, my guest is Dr. Sonia Santelices. She began her tenure as the CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools on the 1st of July. We'd be delighted to have you join the conversation. You can give us a call at 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wipr.org. And we've got a new Twitter handle for you. Reach out with a tweet, @MiddayTomHall, @MiddayTomHall. So, Dr. Santelices, what do you think about this executive order by the governor to have school begin the day after Labor Day?
So what we have been saying, and what I'll just continue to say, is that, you know, when school starts or ends, you know, the bottom line for us is, for a lot of our young people here in city schools, we are already trying to provide enriching summer experiences for them. Now, for some families in our schools, that's not an issue, but for many families, it is. And so we have just lodged our concern that lengthening the summer actually puts a large number of our kids at greater risk for summer learning loss, greater risk for not having access to food and nutrition, not having access to recreational opportunities. So I think what we have said all along is, you know, we need to take into account our population here in Baltimore City. And we also need, you know, we're going to have to make some hard decisions about school calendar, because having a set beginning date and end date means that, you know, we're going to have to do things like look at spring break, look at other points during the year where we can recapture that time. So
everybody's been saying they're going to look at spring break. When is the looking going to happen?
Well, I mean, we actually have drafts.
Yeah, I bet you do. I mean, what does that mean for spring break? That
it ain't gonna means happen? It could be shorter. I mean, we have some other contractual pieces that we have to look at that might require at least 1 or 2 days. But we, at least my last check-in with the team that was reviewing this, is we could take back as many as three or four days from spring break. So it wouldn't mean the entire break goes away, but, you know, taking off on one Friday and coming back the following Monday and having an extended vacation will be out of the picture if that's what families are looking for.
I mean, as a general philosophy, Mm-hmm. Is it a good idea for the state to dictate the calendar of the school systems in each different jurisdiction around the state, or should each individual jurisdiction be figuring this out on its own?
We have joined a resounding number of local school districts that maintain, and I will go on record as saying we do believe it's a decision that is best made at the local level, because communities are different. And in the same way that some communities want and feel very strongly about a post-Labor Day start, we have other communities for other reasons that don't. And we do believe that should be a local decision.
Dr. Sonia Santelises is the CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools. On the line, we have Shay from Roland Park. This is a comment about the amount of homework that is expected. Shay, welcome to Midday. Glad you could join us.
Hi. Thank you, Tom. And thank you, Doctor. I'm not even going to try to pronounce the last name.
That's all right. That's all right.
Destroy it. I have just a couple quick things to say about kids. My daughter went to Roland Park. She just progressed to Baltimore School for the Arts, so we're very proud.
Very good.
And my comment and question is, activity is so important for young kids, physical activity and friendships and social time and family time, and I am so, dismayed because of the huge amount of homework that our children are given. My daughter and all of her friends, some were in Ingenuity, which is amazing. Some were in advanced academics, some were in general. But these children, people say, they just have a half hour and a half homework a night. That could not be further from the truth.
Yeah, well, Shay, I appreciate the comment. So, Dr. Santelises, this is something that's a national conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Are we working kids too much? but, of course, it comes down to the expectations we have for these young people at different times in their academic careers. What's your thought of it? What's the latest thinking on this?
So, and there is varied thinking throughout the country on this. There are some districts that are contemplating doing away with homework. We are not in that camp right now. I will say this, though, that what we try to keep in mind is the developmental appropriateness of the amount of work that young people are getting at home. So, if a second grader is coming home and crying over homework, and can't do it, or requires, a parent or a family member to sit down with them to do it for the entire time, I would call into question whether that's the kind of homework we need to be given. I think the second kind of overarching question that I ask schools, and we give a lot of autonomy, by the way, to schools on shaping homework. So we don't, we don't dictate one way or the other. But I will say the other piece we keep in mind is this meaningful activity, right? Is this activity one that is a reinforcement of what's going on? And is it an opportunity for young people to extend their thinking? It also varies by program. So I believe the caller talked about the program that her child was in, right? And so Ingenuity is a rigorous math and science program. And so we know that advanced study in those topic areas often does require a deeper investment in homework time than another program might. And so one of the things I ask parents to keep in mind is, one, not only the amount, the developmental appropriateness of it, but also the relevancy. That there are teachers around the city who give fantastic homework assignments because they're making kids think, their applications, and also it's going to vary throughout a young person's career. But it should not be busy work. We shouldn't be giving it as some kind of obligatory function. It should have purpose, and it doesn't have to be painful. It can be exciting.
James joins us from Baltimore City. He's worried about scores, as many people are. James, welcome to Midday. Glad you could be with us.
Thank you for the opportunity. Good afternoon to
Good
you
afternoon.
Guys.
Good
My
afternoon.
Name is Mr. Williams, and I've got the water turned off in the school system in 2003. But I'm an advocate. I've been advocating for 20 years for students, and the reading scores have fluctuated over decades, but the math scores have never been good in Baltimore City for decades. My question is, what is the school system going to do to address this deficiency that Baltimore City school systems has had over decades and continues to have as far as math learning for our students in Baltimore City in particular? Because I have a grandson that's in the second grade, and the math that he brought home, personally, I couldn't. It gave me a headache, much less a second grader. But the math skills and the science, technology, engineering, and math components that are not in the early grades, much less the higher grades across the board, show that our students are doing poorly in math, and the school system has to address math, and they never have ever. So what are you going to do differently than your predecessors?
Well, James, I appreciate the comment. You know, Doctor, in the PARCC test, the P-A-R-C-C, and you can refresh mm-hmm. my memory as to what that means. I can never remember what that acronym is.
But, yes, go ahead.
It means something having to do with academic testing, and the two of us will look it up as soon as we're done.
Sure.
But in math, only 7% of kids in 2015 met or exceeded the expectations. It was 25% statewide. So James, you know, it brings up a good point. Just in general, how do we move this needle forward? What's the general consensus on pedagogically what we can be doing to help these kids get this stuff better?
So one point I do want to make initially is that the district in some places actually had been seeing an uptick. No, it was not. We didn't have all children where they needed to be. It wasn't a final kind of destination arrival. But the district, over the course of the years, has seen some growth and progress. And so I think we need to, one, build on that. Two, I will say, the figures you released about the PARCC are one of the reasons why we're taking a deep dive. And really getting underneath, do students understand what the math, the meaning behind the math is, number one, and number two, do they have automaticity, meaning, you know, they're still principles and facts within math that you need to have at kind of rapid recall, for lack of a better term.
And that's called automaticity?
There you go. We call it automaticity.
The word for the day here at
Midday. Please don't. Please don't. We don't need any other people quoting educationese. Leave it to us. Don't bother yourself with it. But I will say this, that part of why you'll see the achievement levels for students are so low on this exam is this is the first time we have assessed at this level of depth students' understanding of the concepts behind mathematics, not just can you plug and play the numbers and the digits in the right place. And so what we are really moving to do now is to even ramp up teachers' understanding of the mathematics and the concepts behind it versus just, you know, how numbers of us learned, you know, carry the 10, you know, multiply here, you know, drop it down a row. And what we found out is that over the course of the country, I mean, across the country, our young people, compared to their international peers, didn't have the time to go in depth conceptually. So what you will see and should be seeing in more city schools is young people writing about how they went about the answer. You should see more multi-step problems within all grade levels, not just waiting until
so that a teacher can assess whether or not the child understands what she's doing.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I will say this, that even my daughters, you know, who've gone through city schools now know more math in second grade and fifth grade than I did at that time. They understand the concepts behind it, and a lot of it is because of this shift. But part of why the achievement level is so low is we were just giving kids digits for a long time. And then go ahead.
But we've got sort of two issues, it seems to me. Uh-huh. First of all, is assessing it, so testing, and we'll
Absolutely.
Talk about that in a minute. The other is contact hours. I mean, you know, we talk about beginning the school year on Labor Day and ending, you know, a hard stop
exactly.
on June 15th. Earl writes from Catonsville, we should be extending the school year,
Agreed.
Not shortening it. The
Agreed.
Rest of the world is leaving us
That's right.
in the dust.
That's right.
So, I mean, make the day longer.
Mm-hmm.
Make the school year longer. 12-month school years. I mean, kids don't want to hear that. Some parents don't want to hear that. Maybe
don't.
Some teachers don't want to hear
mm-hmm.
it. But, you know, there's an awful lot of folks who think that that's really the only way to catch up.
Well, and I would agree. I mean, I do think that the question should be around more learning time. And I think also making sure that the quality of the learning time is of the highest level. One of the things we found a couple of years ago was we took some of our lowest performing, and I have to give the credit to my math department and the folks who were working there at the time, but when I was chief academic officer, we took some of the lowest performing young people in the city in mathematics, and we gave them summer robotics. And so, and a lot of people turned and said, oh, well, shouldn't that just be for the high achieving kids? And we actually found that when you accelerate and engage and have real high level application in science and tech fields of mathematics, that our young people accelerate the learning. And so a lot of those kids who were coming in, you know, 2-3 years behind gained time because those extra months in the summer were not spent just doing more worksheets. They were actually applying their knowledge, and we saw gains. So I think that that's the other piece. It's a combination of time and contact hours. It's also how are we preparing teachers to be able to teach at that level of depth? And then third, making sure that young people have lots of opportunities to see math and application at the same time that we're ramping up the level that we expect them to achieve at.
Dr. Sonia Santelises is the CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday here on 88.1 WIPR. You work for a think tank in D.C. called the Education Trust for a while, and you wrote about statewide tests, which is a very hot button issue for the folks who work for you and the students who are in the system. Tests, you wrote, are meant to chart progress toward high academic achievement for all students, not to become the sole focus of classroom time. This is something I hear from teachers all the time, teaching to the test. Dr. Alonzo, a predecessor or two before you, was very big on giving principals and teachers a lot of autonomy in the schools. From what I understand, your approach tends to be making the curriculum across the schools and across the system a little more standardized. How do you reckon those two things? Can you get people teaching the same curriculum from school to school to school and still maintain a level of autonomy that the teachers seem to want, that's been baked into the cake of their contract? How do you do that? And then what is the role of testing now that you're no longer the chief academic officer, you're the chief cook and bottle washer here?
Yes, I love that. I'm gonna have a nameplate printed up with that. So to your first question, one of the things that I've always maintained and I think has borne out in doing this work over the number of years that I have is when we, and I mean everybody outside of schools, actually offer teachers high quality curriculum, high quality materials, they actually don't have a problem using that. Where it comes into conflict is in two places. One, when an individual wants to do something that's contrary to how we know kids learn. So that's number one. Like, we don't just pick things out of the air because we like this particular unit. It should be because it actually connects with young people. And two, the curriculum we're providing them should be of a rich enough level that they actually want to use it as the foundation. So I was in a high school last week, and I stopped into an English class, a high school English class, and I asked, there were two teachers team teaching, a special educator and then a regular education educator in English, and they were team teaching, and I was watching them work with some of our curriculum with their class, and I asked the teacher, I said, well, you know, how is this working for you? Does this relate? And he said, you know, it does, but we've had to make some tweaks. And I said, well, tell me about the tweaks. Well, the tweaks that teacher team and at the time the young people, you know, had been reading, you know, A Modest Proposal, and then they were shifting to do some work on sanitation worker strike during Martin Luther King's speech. And I said, well, how is that going? And they said, well, you know, we're also finding that we need to link some of this to what young people have questions about now. So how does this link to Black Lives Matter? How does this link to community mobilization? And that is more than appropriate, right? So teachers were using the foundational curriculum, but they were doing what good teachers do, and that is making the connections to young people's lives. So,
and of course, one of the advantages of standardizing the curriculum across the schools is that your job is going to be assessed on those scores. I mean, no one's hipper that fact than you.
That's true.
You know, so if you've got different schools teaching different things, that may have a deleterious impact on the overall school's performance when it comes to test scores. Yeah.
Well, and the other piece is, like, we still want innovation. There are still classrooms where people are innovating. They're not, you know, we have a number of charter schools who are doing equally well with young people. But my philosophy is, if we're providing quality, if we're giving thinking people, right, so thinking teachers, thinking principals, the ability, the autonomy to be able to make those adjustments for kids, and we're helping them get smarter about the work, they should be able to do that.
All right. Well, we will come back and pick up with that and a bunch of other stuff. Time now for another quick break. Again, give us a call, 410-662-8780. Drop us an email, midday@wipr.org, or send us a tweet, @MiddayTomHall. We've got more coming up with Dr. Sonia Sontalesis, the CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools. Stick around. And welcome back to Midday on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall, continuing our conversation with Dr. Sonia Sontalesis. You can give us a call at 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wipr.org, or give us a tweet, @MiddayTomHall. The relationship that you enjoy with the union, the teachers union, with Marietta English, who's the head of the teachers union, obviously they knew you. You were a known quantity when mm-hmm. you came mm-hmm. because you were here for 3 years and then left for a few years and then came back. How would you characterize that relationship, and what do you think that's going to mean moving forward?
So I actually think we've had a very good working relationship. I have with Ms. English and the Baltimore Teachers Union. That does not mean we've agreed on everything, but it does mean that we have really tried both to keep young people as the center of our conversations. But, you know, yes, we disagree from time to time on how to get there, but we have really, really tried to strive to approach this from a partnership stance, which I have appreciated. And that is not the position that occurs in a number of places nationally, and we have benefited from that here in Baltimore City.
The Port Covington development, mm-hmm. a lot of discussion about its potential deleterious impact on the budget of the Baltimore City Public Schools. Mm-hmm. If the property values are seen to have been going up in the city of Baltimore, that lowers the amount of funding we get from the state for the Baltimore City Public Schools, at least according to the current formula. There's some discussion about the legislature adjusting that formula, but obviously you pay close attention to this. What do you think?
So what we've said, what I have said, is that I'm looking for the impact. And as you noted, we are watching closely. We're working. We've had numerous, numerous elected officials. We've had the folks from Sagamore be very, very supportive of making sure that this deal does not have a negative impact on city school long-term funding. But we all also acknowledge we have a lot of work to do. We have a lot of work to do moving forward, paying attention to the new school funding formula for the state. We also need to make sure that we're working together to monitor what that is going to mean for city schools in actual dollars. And
what should the formula include? What's a good formula?
Well, that's a loaded question. So I'm you know.
Allow me.
Well, let me tell you this. I do think that there are considerations. So we know that states, and this is the advantage of having come from an organization that monitors state funding formulas, I would say that there are considerations, right? So the questions I would ask are there going to be considerations in the state funding formula for concentration of poverty, right? What will that look like? How does that pan out? I think a school funding formula, as most would attest to, needs to take into account real and actualized wealth in the lives of its citizens as opposed to wealth on paper. And so some of those questions are the kind that will be asked. And we're, again, looking forward to engaging in those. But it is definitely something that we're watching, but also something that we've had a lot of goodwill expressed and a lot of people lending support and a willingness to get in there with us, which is really what we need.
Dr. Sonia Sontalesis, the CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools. We have Devorah on the line, or Devorah, forgive me if I'm not pronouncing your name correctly, calling from Glen Burnie. Welcome to Midday. All right. How about we'll move to Craig in Towson. We seem to have lost Deborah. Craig calling from Towson. What's your question for Dr. Sonia Santelises?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a concern. I know the conversation around extending the school year, and I thought earlier that Dr. Sonia was in favor of that. I have a big concern that there's so many things that happen developmentally and formationally for our young people outside of the school system, and that happened a lot in the summer, either with families or the extracurriculars they're involved with. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to possibly how, if that's a concern you share, what would happen if we did extend the school year? How we might find time, especially for families who might utilize that time to reconnect with each other, the possible negative effects we might have a concern or have an effect on our young people if they engage in classroom work throughout the school year.
Yeah, so the question is about, you know, is there a downside to extending the school year? We hear from Sandy via email who says, students have so many days off, one or two at a time in the middle of the year for teacher development days. Why not move them all into the summer so students can retain their spring break and still be able to start school after Labor Day? I mean, so there's always two sides to
there is always two sides. And I would, I would never say that my side's the only side. But I will say this to the callers, concern, and I think rightly so in terms of the flag. One of the things that we see in other districts across the country that have moved to year-round schooling, that it's not just whole chunks of time, right? So students still receive breaks, right? There are still those 2 weeks, and I think in some cases 3 weeks, where families do spend time together, where children do have time off. It is just not a long kind of 9 to 10 week block without any instruction, without any connection with school. But no, I'm certainly not saying, both as a parent as well as an educator, that students should be in school all of the time. I think it's the length of the breaks that we need to watch. And to Deborah, I think it was, who emailed in. I can't remember.
Sandy,
mm-hmm. who emailed in. We are taking a look at professional development days, but I will say this, that we also know, based on kind of best practice with teacher learning as well, it's very similar to young people. We can jam it all in the summer, but what teachers tell us is to give it to us in one shot and never check back in. We're not getting the leverage from our investment in professional development if we just do it once and then move on.
Let's talk about charter schools.
Yeah.
And a difficult personal decision that you and your husband have to make or had to make about one of your daughters. Two of your daughters attend Baltimore City charter schools. Mm-hmm. And one of them is a high school student, as I understand it, at a private school.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, people are going to say, well, if the CEO doesn't send her kids, all three of them, to a city school, why should I?
Sure. And actually, I'll just correct that our eldest is actually going to middle school, not high.
Okay. I'm rushing things.
No, that's
she's
please.
Got plenty of time.
I was going to say, please, I don't want the driving to begin yet. I'm trying to hold off. So, I've gone on record as saying that this was a personal decision that my husband and I made, and we looked at who my daughter was as an individual and what she needed at the time and who she was, and that was the best placement for her. And like I've said before, I made that decision with my husband, not with the entire city. And I have a role as a CEO and as a mother. The other piece I will say is that all three of my girls have been in Baltimore City Public Schools since they entered. And my oldest, since she was in pre-K. And our two youngest, who are still in Baltimore City Public Schools, albeit a charter, but in Baltimore City, our charter schools are public schools. But one of the things that I stand by, and I think my record attests to, and I have been incredibly consistent in this one element throughout my career, that the way that I view educating other people's children, the way that I view educating every child in Baltimore City, and principals will tell you this, our operations team will tell you this, our assessment team, anybody in city school should be able to tell you. My refrain is always, if it is not good enough for my child, if it is not good enough for your child, it's not good for anyone else's. And so that frame does not change based on the decision that my husband and I had to make as parents. And we still do. We still have two of our three children still are in city schools. We just had to make that decision for our eldest.
On 88.1 WYPR, it's midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest, Dr. Sonia Santelises, the CEO of Baltimore City Public Schools. Jenny joins us from Roland Park. Jenny, welcome to the show. Glad you could call.
Oh, thanks so much for taking my call, and welcome to our new CEO. I'm hearing wonderful things about her. My question is, my kids go to Roland Park Elementary. It's a wonderful school. We have a fabulous principal. Mm-hmm. I'm really pleased overall with the quality of instruction. But I am concerned that every time, you know, when it's hot or when there's a little bit of snow, the school system seems pretty trigger happy to close the schools. And the reason, and we just had a couple half days last week because of heat. And this concerned me because we have an air-conditioned school, so I don't understand why it is a district-wide one-size-fits-all policy that schools are closed, especially in light of the fact is that we do have some low-income kids at our school, and we give those kids meals, and it is a safe, air-conditioned building. So I don't understand why we send kids home
Thanks
on
for
a
your...
hot day in an air-conditioned building.
Yeah, thanks for your call, Jenny. Again, it comes down to this notion of school autonomy.
Yeah, and part of it is really that the critical, that still the majority of our schools, we still have a large number, I should say, of our schools that are not air conditioned. And so the kind of splitting the decision, and believe me, again, I make it both as a parent and as a city administrator, that for us, we have to look at the entire system. And so it isn't just the 70 plus schools, or really, if you count all of them, closer to 80 or 90 schools that do not have air conditioning, some that are slated to. It's too disruptive to the system to have a majority of schools still close and have those kept open. I agree. It would be ideal. I would love to do that.
How's it disruptive, though? I mean, if those students and principals and teachers are there, what's...
Because you still have transportation needs. You have the communication cycle, right? So, and not every family has young people in just one school, right? Not every family's located in just one school. There's also issues about communication around where young people can get meals, as the caller noted. She's fortunate enough to be in an air-conditioned school that provides meals, but we have to be able to facilitate that for the remainder. So it's really the logistics and the operations. If it were that easy, believe me, we would do it, but it requires a whole system to move around.
We're running out of time. I got a lot of emails and calls that we may not get to, but let me ask you about the school police and about safety in the schools. Mm-hmm. Last year in the spring, three students at the Renaissance Academy, or students that had a connection with the Renaissance Academy, killed within, you know, a month of each other.
Yeah.
It's such a difficult situation. There's a controversy about whether or not the police and schools should be armed, whether they should be in the buildings, just outside the building. What's your take?
So our take, and this is where we moved to, was that our school police officers should be in schools. They are unarmed, and they should be part of helping to build healthy school climates. They should be on board as part of the effort to keep young people safe. We, in our deployment, we took into consideration kind of past incidences at the school, the size of the school, and we're also retraining and providing more training to our school police officers so that they're equipped with the tools to better be able to support the overall climate in the schools.
Dr. Sonia Sondalesis is the CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools. We've got a link to the school system's website at WIPR.org/midday. By the way, tomorrow for lunch, elementary school kids will have their choice of shrimp poppers with macaroni and cheese or peanut butter and jelly sandwich sides, steamed carrots, or homegrown side salad. So what are you going with, Dr. Sondalesis? Are you going with a PB&J or poppers?
Yeah, I would tend to be a poppers kind of gal.
That's the wrong answer.
Is that the wrong answer?
You're not going to be able to go on to our grand prize round, but we will have you come back and play again.
Really. Fair enough.
PB&J. You can't turn down PB&J. Speaking of lunch, by the way, we are grateful that lunch for our midday Monday guest is provided by The Diz, located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on weekends. You can find them on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. Let me remind you that you can now catch my friend and colleague Sheila Cast every morning at 9:30 for her new show, On the Record. Tomorrow they're going to be talking about some of the great writers at the Baltimore Sun. That's it for us today. Tomorrow on Midday, author Robert Canigal on his new biography of urban planner Jane Jacobs, and Ed Guntz, who writes about architecture and development for the Baltimore Brew, on the design of Port Covington. We know it's going to cost a lot, but will it be great to look at and to hang around in? That's coming up tomorrow at noon. Until then, thanks for joining us, Dr. Sondalesis.
Thank you.
A pleasure. We'll have you back.
Thanks
look forward
so much
to it. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.